You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Out of Sight by Nick Bilton. The first time Tim Cook experienced the Apple Vision Pro, it wasn't called the Apple Vision Pro. It was years ago, maybe 6, 7, or even 8. Before the company built Apple Park, where we're sitting right now, at a bleached oak table in this incredible circular edifice clad in miles of curved glass. It's been raining, and the clouds are clearing over the pine trees and the rows of citrus and maple trees, and the sun is reflecting off the pond in the meadow, and it's kind of mesmerizing. And Cook's telling me about that time, all those years ago, in his dulcet Robertsdale, Alabama accent, when he first saw it. It was at Mariana 1, a nondescript, low-rise building on the edge of the old Infinite Loop campus, with blacked-out windows. This place is so secret, it's known as one of Apple's Black Ops facilities. Nearly all of the thousands of employees who work at Apple have never set foot inside one. There are multiple layers of doors that lock behind and in front of you. But Cook is the CEO and can go anywhere. So he strolls past restricted rooms where foldable iPhones and MacBooks with retractable keyboards and transparent televisions were dreamed up. Where these devices, almost all of which will never leave this building, are stored in locked Pelican cases inside locked cupboards. This building, after all, is folklore to Apple. It's where the iPod and the iPhone were invented. This same building, where Cook finds the industrial design team working on this thing virtually no one else knows exists. Mike Rockwell, vice president of Apple's Visions Products Group, is there when Cook enters and sees it. It's like a monster, Cook told me, an apparatus. Cook's told to take a seat, and this massive, monstrous machine is placed around his face. It's crude, like a giant box, and it's got screens in it, half a dozen of them layered on top of each other, and cameras sticking out like whiskers. You weren't really wearing it at that time, he told me. It wasn't wearable by any stretch of the imagination. And it's whirring, with big fans, a steady, deep humming sound on both sides of his face. And this apparatus has these wires coming out of it that sinuate all over the floor and stretch into another room where they're connected to a supercomputer, and then buttons are pressed and lights go on, and the CPU and GPU start pulsating at billions of cycles per second, and Tim Cook is on the moon. He's sitting right there on the effing moon with Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong of Apollo 11. He looks around, and there's the ghostly luminescence of ancient dust under a black star-studded sky. It's magnificent. It's amazing. There, in the distance, is the Earth, the blue dot, where all of this magic is happening. But Cook's not just on the moon. He's also in that secret room, in that secret building. And he can see Rockwell and other Apple employees, and he can see his own hands. And he knows right then and there what this all means. Like the universe is telling him something. He knows that this is the future of computing and entertainment and apps and memories, and that this crude apparatus wrapped around his head will change everything. He knows Apple has to make this thing its next product category. What Cook didn't know is how his engineers were going to take this thing that needs a supercomputer and another room and fans and multiple screens and shrink it down to the size of a pair of goggles that weighs a little more than a box of spaghetti. I've known for years we would get here, Cook told me. I didn't know when, but I knew that we would arrive here. The first Apple Vision Pro, in a perfect white cube the size of a large shoebox, arrived in stores in February. Cook was on hand at the flagship New York store, where hardcore fans waited hours for the doors to open. Apple reportedly sold around 200,000 units out of the gate. Of course, the early adopters are easy. What Cook and his army of executives know is that the company still has to convince everyone else that in their own daily lives, for work or entertainment or meditating or capturing the most surreal family memories or all of the above, they need to spend $3,500 on a spatial computer. A headset that makes you look, as a friend put it, like you're going skiing in the Matrix, and on which you can't access popular apps like Netflix and Spotify, at least not yet. It won't be hard to get people to try the Apple Vision Pro. Buying it may be another story. Though fortunately for Apple, those who have already strapped one on seem more than willing to preach about all the wondrous things it can do. I would say my experience was religious, the director James Cameron told me when I asked him about his first encounter with the Apple Vision Pro. I was skeptical at first. I don't bow down before the great God of Apple, but I was really, really blown away. Another prominent filmmaker, Jon Favreau, offered a similar sentiment, telling me he was blown away by the technology and what it will do to storytelling. Favreau created content for Apple specifically to showcase the device's 3D capabilities, where a dinosaur climbs out of a screen and looks like it wants to eat you. I'm excited by what kind of story I can tell now that I couldn't tell before now, he said. And when I called Om Malik, who has been writing about tech since tech reporters wrote about calculators, he was even more effusive. It's amazing. It's incredible, he enthused. You can feel a vibration in the universe. Everyone else I spoke to who has had a chance to try out the Apple Vision Pro, investors, whoa, and designers, wow, and analysts, ooh, and producers, ah. I was thinking about all of those woes and wows and oohs and ahs as I walked up to the Steve Jobs Theater, a round building with walls made of nothing but glass that hold up a massive cylindrical roof that looks like it's resting on air. It was my first time visiting SJT, as they call it, an homage to the man, the legend, the guy who dreamed all of this up. An Apple employee walked out holding a Pelican case the size of a lunchbox, and I knew what was inside. Yeah, it's one of those. And seeing him reminded me that when I had first spoken to Apple months earlier, I had absolutely no desire to try what was inside that case. Zero interest. Not an inkling. I didn't watch Cook's June keynote about the Apple Vision Pro. I didn't read the dissecting blog post or the uninformed conjecture on social media. I just kept scrolling, like I do when I see anything about Harry and Meghan. I told Cook this as I sat with him in the same room where he did that keynote, because I've seen this play before, and I know what the first act is like, and the second act, and I know how it ends. Back in 2013, in a conference room in Los Angeles, I strapped an Oculus VR headset to my head for the first time. Oculus, a well-funded startup, would later be purchased by Facebook, which would later rename itself Meta. It was cool, sure. I offered my proverbial wow and gave out a few oohs and ahs as I played a video game with brutalist square-edged graphics that looked like Pablo Picasso had smoked too much opium and designed a digital world. But after a few minutes, I felt claustrophobic. And by the intermission, I was mired in an existential crisis that maybe I had stopped inhabiting the real world because I could only see myself in the virtual one. Over the last decade, as the graphics became smoother and the chips faster, the same thing kept happening with each new VR device, Rift, Vive, Quest, Quest 2, and Quest 3. I used them all once or twice, and then they went into a drawer or a cupboard or a box in my basement because I didn't want to feel the claustrophobia of putting something on my face. Then last August, I was invited to Apple's Los Angeles office, formerly the home of Beats, to experience what I thought would be yet another VR device. I was sitting in a sleek room with white oak furniture and polished floors, and all I was thinking about was how long it would take me to get home, and whether I'd take the local streets, because the 405 by that hour is just a nightmare. I sat on this gray couch, and an Apple employee told me to reach out and grab the Apple Vision Pro in front of me and place it on my head, which I did, reluctantly, just wanting to get this over with. And then, as I expected, the world disappeared, as it always does with VR headsets. But that only lasted for a few seconds, because a digital curtain pulled back, and behind it was the real world. I could see my arms and legs, and then the Apple app icons popped up in front of me like a multicolored apparition. This was as far from a VR headset as a kid's Schwinn bicycle is from a Gulfstream G800 private jet. Just as when I scrolled my finger around the wheel of the first iPod, or used my finger and thumb to zoom into an image on the first iPhone, with the Vision Pro, I could look at an app icon and simply tap my fingers together, and the app would open. And then it was hanging in front of me, in the clearest resolution I'd ever seen in my life. I could swipe through images with my hands, move things with my fingers. Unlike other VR headsets, where you have to use a controller that feels like you have lobster claws for hands, with the Apple Vision Pro, your eyes become the mouse absolutely seamlessly. "It's mind-blowing," Cook said to me when I told him about my experience. "We live in a 3D world, but the content that we enjoy is flat." During that first demo, I went to the iconic Mount Hood stratovolcano in Oregon, and I could hear and see a million raindrops falling into Mirror Lake, so much so that I felt like I was there. And the only thing missing was the earthy scent of rain-soaked soil. I interacted with graphics in midair that were crisper than anything I'd ever seen before, and I touched them all with my fingers, not a mouse or keyboard. I saw spatial videos for the first time. To say this feature is astounding is an understatement. You actually feel like the person is in front of you, and you can reach out and touch them. I saw clips of movies that were 100 feet wide, sharper and clearer than any IMAX. But most importantly, I saw the world around me, that very room. I didn't feel closed off or claustrophobic. I was there. I was everywhere all at once. I left the Apple offices that day and went to a nearby coffee shop. And when I opened my laptop, a relatively new computer, it felt like a relic pulled from the rubble of a Soviet-era power plant. You know, one of our most common reactions we love is people go, "Hold on, I just need a minute. I need to process what just happened," said Greg Jaws Joswiak, Apple's Senior Vice President of Worldwide Marketing, as we ate lunch at Apple Park. How cool is that? How often do people have a product experience where they're left speechless, right? I wasn't really left speechless until the second demo. A few months after my initial experience, I went back to the LA offices. Two Apple employees led me into a room. I put on the Apple Vision Pro, and the curtain opened, and I was looking at them. The only difference this time was I had a cup of tea with me. In the middle of this new demo, I reached down and grabbed the tea, and I took a sip. And as I did, one of my fingers flickered like I was in a simulation no different from reality, and there was a glitch. "Wait, what am I seeing?" I asked, confused. "Are you real, or..." "No, you're seeing a video of us that's being rendered in real time," one of the employees explained. I sat there for a moment speechless. I had thought what I had been seeing was the real world, and that all the digital wonder was layered on top of that. That the Apple Vision Pro was transparent, and there was a layer of technology on top of it. In reality, it was the other way around. I think it's not evolutionary, it's revolutionary, Cameron said to me when I told him about my experience. And I'm speaking as someone who has worked in VR for 18 years. He explained that the reason it looks so real is because the Apple Vision Pro is writing a 4K image into my eyes. That's the equivalent of the resolution of a 75-inch TV into each of your eyeballs, 23 million pixels. To put that into perspective, the average 4K television has around 8 million pixels. Apple engineers didn't slice off a rectangle from the corner of a 4K display and put it in the Apple Vision Pro. They somehow compressed almost three times as many pixels into a space as small as your eyeball. This, to people like Cameron, who have been working in this space for two decades, solves every problem. But even with all this wonder, with 23 million pixels that are so clear and crisp that you can't tell reality from a digital composite of it, there are some problems Apple hasn't solved, at least not yet. There's an old story about Steve Jobs that has become folklore in Silicon Valley. It takes place about 25 years ago in that same nondescript Black Ops building, Mariani 1, where Cook would see the first Apple Vision Pro prototype years later. Back then, in the late 90s, Jobs had a team of engineers building the first iPod. They're toiling away, bending physics and doing engineering acrobatics to make the smallest prototype of an iPod they can squeeze into a box. Finally, when it can't get any smaller, they take it to Jobs. Now, these prototypes cost millions of dollars, sometimes more. And Jobs looks at it, he inspects it, and he says it needs to be smaller. The engineers say it's as small as it can get. And Jobs walks over to a fish tank and drops the prototype in. Splash! And as it drowns, Jobs says, "You see those air bubbles? That means you can make it smaller. You've got your M2 chip here, R1 chip, near zero latency, 5,000 patents, 7 years. Richard Howarth, the vice president of industrial design, said in a thick Leicester accent as he pointed to the dozens of disassembled components splayed out in front of me, all of which made up the cadaver of the Apple Vision Pro. And yet, all I could think about was the fish story and that iPod prototype, and whether Jobs, if he were alive today, would throw the Apple Vision Pro into a fish tank and say, 'There's bubbles, make it smaller.' If there's one consistent grumble about the Apple Vision Pro, it's about the size and weight. It's around 20 ounces, which might not sound like a lot, because you cook with ounces, you don't necessarily wear them. But that's the same as 5 sticks of butter. Imagine walking around with 5 sticks of butter on your face all day. Carolina Cruz Nayira, a pioneer of virtual reality, told me that the way a device sits on your face really impacts how you respond to the technology. I've been working in VR for over 30 years, and until we can get the scuba diving mask off your face and we make it less noticeable, we're not going to make this a mass adoption technology, Cruz Nayira said. And the size and weight of the scuba diving mask are not going to be solved in a year. It's largely this question that will determine if the Apple Vision Pro will be a financial success. Morgan Stanley anticipates that sales will ramp up to 2 million to 4 million units a year over the next 5 years, and it will become a new product category for the company. But others, like Ming-Chi Kuo, an Apple supply chain analyst, think it's going to remain a niche product for some time. Almost all the analysts I spoke with believe it will eventually get there. We think a few years from now, it'll resemble sunglasses and be less than $1,500. Dan Ives, a senior analyst at the investment firm Wedbush Securities, told me. I didn't even have to ask Howarth about the weight. He brought it up himself. But he did so as he explained that this component and that component are made of magnesium and carbon fiber and aluminum. He pronounced it aluminium, not aluminum, which I respected as a Brit myself, and he noted that these are the lightest materials on Earth, and that there is no more diminutive alternative. There's nothing we could have done to make it lighter or smaller, Haworth explained. This is the state of the art. Everyone else I spoke to at Apple proffered a similar sentiment. It feels like we've reached into the future and grabbed this product, Joswiak said to me. You're putting the future on your face. As did Rockwell, who told me, we packed just about as much technology as you could possibly pack into that small a form factor. You can actually lay on your sofa and put the displays on your ceiling if you wish, Cook told me. I watched the third season of Ted Lasso on my ceiling, and it was unbelievable. When I got home and hooked up my own Apple Vision Pro, I watched Ford versus Ferrari on my ceiling. And with the spatial audio, it felt like Ken Miles' Ford GT40 was in the room with me. I think meditation is on a different level than anything I've ever experienced, and I've meditated for a long time, Cook said. I've always had trouble meditating, and he was right about that, too. And I use it for productivity, Cook told me. Typing with the Apple Vision Pro virtual keyboard is a little like trying to write with a pen between your toes. Not impossible, but impractical. But when I opened my MacBook Pro while wearing the Vision Pro, the screen popped into my augmented reality, and I was able to work pretty seamlessly. I'm actually writing these words here, the ones you're reading, on the Vision Pro, using the MacBook. And all I can say is I bet if you were watching me now, you'd think I look just like Tom Cruise in Minority Report, only slightly more handsome. And then there are those spatial videos. I've recorded and watched dozens of spatial videos of my kids just playing and talking, reliving moments that seem mundane, but when played back are so emotionally immersive, it's like stepping into a living, breathing memory. Again, it's hard to describe how realistic the environments feel, but I found myself periodically returning to Mirror Lake, turning off all my notifications, and just sitting there at the edge of the water, peacefully watching and listening to the rain for 5 or 10 minutes before returning to work. There are plenty of quirks using the device. One of my favorites is when you use the Vision Pro in one room and then go to another, open the same app, and you have to find it by looking all around the room. Sometimes it's on the ceiling or the floor. I couldn't find my text app the other day and turned around to find it was in my bathroom. I later learned you can reset the apps by pressing the digital crown for a few seconds. But the more I've used the Apple Vision Pro over the past 2 weeks, the more one glaring problem revealed itself to me. It's not the weight, which is a problem, but will come down over time, or the size, which will shrink with each iteration, or the worry that it will drive us to consume more content alone. Almost half of Americans already watch TV alone. Or how tech giants like Meta, Netflix, and Spotify are currently withholding their apps from the device. Content creators may come around once the consumers are there, and some, like Disney, are already embracing the device, making 150 movies available in 3D, including from mega franchises like Star Wars and Marvel. And it's not even the price. Because if Apple wanted to, the company could subsidize the cost of the Apple Vision Pro, and it would have about as much financial impact as Cook losing a nickel between his couch cushions. I'm talking about something that I don't see a solution for. I first recognized the problem when I was at Apple Park, in the basement offices of SJT. I was seeing yet another demo, this time in Joshua Tree, where I sat in the striking desert silhouette of the arid landscape. I played Fruit Ninja, where I got to slice fruit with my bare hands. Then I tried a DJ app, where a turntable opened in front of me, and I could slide the fader, tweak the mixer, and scratch the records. And I summoned a disco ball that magically clung to the ceiling as animated ravers danced around me. In the middle of my DJ set, an Apple employee said it was time to wrap up. I took the Apple Vision Pro off, And that's when it hit me, the problem. It happened again at home, scrolling through the spatial videos I've taken of my kids, seeing them as if they're actually in front of me. And it's going to happen in a few minutes, when I finish writing this article and the Word document in front of me the size of an IMAX screen goes away. When I take it off, every other device feels flat and boring. My 75-inch OLED TV feels like a CRT from the 90s. My iPhone feels like a flip phone from yesteryear. And even the real world around me feels surprisingly flat. And this is the problem. In the same way that I can't imagine driving a car without a stereo, in the same way I can't imagine not having a phone to communicate with people or take pictures of my children, in the same way I can't imagine driving to work without a computer, I can see a day when we all can't imagine living without an augmented reality, when we're enveloped more and more by technology, to the point that we crave these glasses like a drug, like we crave our iPhones today, but with more desire for the dopamine hit this resolution of AR can deliver. I know deep down that the Apple Vision Pro is too immersive, and yet all I want to do is see the world through it. I'm sure the technology is terrific. I still think and hope it fails, one Silicon Valley investor said to me. Apple feels more and more like a tech fentanyl dealer that poses as a rehab provider. Harsh words, but he feels what we all feel, a slave to our smartphone, and he's seen this play before, and he knows what the first act is like, and the second act, and he knows how it ends. I didn't ask Cook about this, because I didn't realize it until days later, but I did ask him if technology is moving too quickly. If all of it, AI, spatial computing, and our reliance on technology, if it's just too much. What does the future of it all look like? I asked Cook. I think it's hard to predict exactly, he replied. But you're making it, I said, so don't you get to predict it? What we do is we get really excited about something, and then we start pulling the string and see where it takes us, Cook told me. And yes, we've got things on the roadmaps and so forth, and yes, we have a definitive point of view. But a lot of it is also the exploration and figuring out. He concluded, sometimes the dots connect, and they lead you to someplace that you didn't expect. Letting connected dots lead the way was a theme Cook's predecessor used to talk about. The question is the place we're about to go into the era of spatial computing going to make our lives better, or will it become the next technology that becomes a necessity, where we can't live in a world that's not augmented? I think Joswiak had it half right when he said, it feels like we've reached into the future and grabbed this product. You're putting the future on your face. I think it's the other way around. Apple is taking us into the future, into a new era of computing. Some of us are running as fast as we can to get there, and others are being dragged, kicking and screaming. But we're all going. We're going to the moon, and we're going to look around at the ghostly luminescence of ancient dust under a black star-studded sky, and we'll just know that this is the future of computing and entertainment and apps and memories, and that this apparatus wrapped around our head will change everything. The Confessions of Inigo Philbrick. The Wunderkind dealer personified the art market's wealth-generating potential and its unregulated excesses, until he pleaded guilty in what was the largest art fraud in U.S. history. Now out of prison and wearing the scarlet letter, Philbrick is searching for a second act. By Mark Seal. Opening photo shows two images of Philbrick. Mirror images of each other. And in the next photos, double dealer. After making his name at London's White Cube Gallery, pictured here, Inigo Philbrick began selling percentages of artwork he didn't always control. Episode 1, The Pitch. Inigo Philbrick awakens at dawn to see what the morning's email will bring. Philbrick, 36, was once one of the most accomplished and admired young art dealers of his generation. Yet when we begin our correspondence in April 2023, he is prisoner 05863093 in Allenwood, a low-security federal prison in rural Pennsylvania, serving a 7-year sentence for what the FBI believes is the largest art-based fraud scheme in U.S. history. There are no doors, and the noise is like a spring break bar at peak capacity. Banter and arguments and all clamoring against the most unforgiving acoustics, linoleum and cement, he says via CoreLinks, the national prison email system around which his days now revolve. There's constantly a screaming argument about how much money Jay-Z has or if a certain BMW is faster than a Mercedes. Everyone professes innocence in prison, the saying goes, but Philbrick has already pleaded guilty to one count of wire fraud. Now, a force perhaps as fierce and formidable as the federal government is seeking his public confessionals. Movie, TV, and documentary producers in a dogfight over the rights for Philbrick's story. At 6 a.m., he lines up before a row of desktop computers, which inmates compete to use at 5 cents a minute. Occasionally kneeling for lack of a chair, he reads the pitches as they come. From 2010 to 2019, Philbrick cut a swath through the highest echelons of international art. Dozens of extremely wealthy collectors bought, or thought they bought, percentages in multi-million dollar pieces from Philbrick. Many discovered that he'd sold the same shares to others, and in some cases didn't have a full ownership stake to sell in the first place. Philbrick is at his inbox, seeking a path to a post-prison future in an outside world that either wants him for the $86 million he owes in restitution or for entertainment on screen. There's so little in this system that allows a man to feel successful or improve himself, he says. Cut away family, cut away friends, cut away work, what's left of a person. For Philbrick, what's left is his story. The art world is unregulated, Philbrick tells me, but I am continually amazed by the promises and declarations producers will make. The breathless tone that today is my last chance to speak, before they made their final edits. In London, where Philbrick launched his career, his fiancée, Victoria Baker Harbour, has been equally inundated. At least 100 people writing me from the moment he was arrested, says Baker Harbour, who is well known in the UK from her high heel turn on the reality show Made in Chelsea. She and Philbrick helped produce a treatment, but they've never told their side of the story. Until now, sitting or kneeling before the prison computer keyboard, Philbrick spent 8 months chronicling his life and alleged crimes to me. I was also struck by how few of the people I've interacted with since entering the Bureau of Prisons have even a conception of what an art dealer does, Philbrick wrote. The Inigo Philbrick story began with a week-old baby in a carriage in an East London gallery. At the helm was Jane Philbrick, a Barnard-educated playwright and artist. Her husband, Harry Philbrick, was a painter and curator. They named their newborn after the famed 1600s British architect Inigo Jones. They moved to New York when Inigo was four. A few years later, Harry was named director of the Aldrich Contemporary Art Museum in Ridgefield, Connecticut. The job took Inigo and his family to the leafy Fairfield County town of Reading, the summer home of Societe Anonyme, an arts organization launched in 1920 by the artists Catherine Dreyer, Marcel Duchamp, and Man Ray to promote and exhibit modern art. "Early on, I spent a lot of time in artist studios," says Philbrick. "I became fluent in that world and enjoyed seeing what artists were working on. I wanted to be a lawyer, but I was soon fascinated by the commerce of the gallery world." In adolescence, a foul wind blew his perfect world apart. A scorching divorce, as Philbrick puts it. His father eventually landed at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, and Philbrick went from carefree, art-obsessed 18-year-old to helping support his mother and younger sister. Just before Philbrick headed off to Thailand for his gap year, his mother attended a cocktail party in the London home of the Sun King of the city's thriving art market, Jay Jopling. In the 1990s, Jopling, through his landmark gallery, White Cube, fostered a generation of talent that came to be known as the Young British Artist, or YBAs, including Damien Hirst, Tracy Emin, and Sam Taylor Wood. At the party, a White Cube employee happened to hear Jane discussing an internship for her son with an American fashion designer. "Why don't you send him to us instead?" the White Cube employee asked. Back home in Connecticut, she presented the two offers to her son. "Well, the gallery, obviously," Philbrick said without hesitation. He arrived at White Cube for a 3-month apprenticeship and never really left. He enrolled at Goldsmiths, University of London, the premier school for young art hotshots. The gallery paid half of his tuition the first year. After graduating in 2009, he rented a house in Bloomsbury next to the British Museum. He was still an intern, sitting on White Cube's acquisitions committee, which seeks out artists worthy of the gallery's representation. At one of the committee's meetings, Jopling presented a work by the video artist Marco Brambilla. Entitled Civilization, it's a swirling, pixelated, gargoyles-on-fire-filled video mural. Jopling felt it worthy of White Cube, but Philbrick says he found it, well, hilarious, and began riotously laughing. "Inigo, that's enough," Jopling said. The next day, an email arrived, summoning Philbrick to the executive office. Philbrick gathered his papers, thinking he was done for, finished, exiled to Nowheresville. Instead, Jopling offered him a proper job and a title, assistant collections manager, along with a percentage of sales. "Initially, working for Jay full-time, barely paid a living wage," he writes. "I was earning something like £28,000 a year, then 50, then 100. I was 23. Episode 2, The Young Wolf. Philbrick set flight, his college clothes replaced with $7,000 chiton suits, his pub ales with $5,000 flagons of Petrus Bordeaux and Romanée Conti Burgundy. Soon he had a gallery to run, the Jopling-backed Modern Collections. "Too much, too young," ask a 2011 art newspaper headline, referring to the gallery's array of young artists in a secondary or resale market that has historically relied upon dead or aging artists for its supply. But this was the new world, and Jopling and his protege were at its forefront. According to Philbrick, he was already giving advice that Jay was following on things to buy, things to offer clients, top clients who needed a bonbon. "He'd given me a little fund to manage, 500,000 GBP as I remember, 20% upside to me, and we were traveling for auctions together, seeing the sales, having lunch," Philbrick writes. He was clever, ambitious. He had an eye and an incredible sense for business, Joplin told Le Monde after Philbrick's arrest for an article in which the French paper dubbed him the Young Wolf. To ensure the best works came to him, the Young Wolf learned how to stand out. The kind of things he was doing on a weekly basis would keep me up nights on end, says a friend. He would take a private jet in the way that I would take a bus. We would have dinners quite frequently, the two of us, which would end up costing what I took home in a month. Raising his paddles in every major auction, Philbrick became a constant presence at all of the stops in the circus, as art collectors call it, the Sotheby's, Christie's, and Phillips auctions, Art Basel, Miami, and Switzerland, Frieze, London, and Paris, the New York art fairs, and beyond. He became the darling of what one observer calls the new collecting class, to whom he offered something as coveted as the art itself, the VIP treatment. You don't want to buy a ticket, the observer says. That's déclassé. He was offering access to a lifestyle. The word that comes up most often in the Philbrick saga is charm. He was, one client tells me, polished, very convincing, profound in his in-depth knowledge of these artists on the secondary market. Integral to the lifestyle was the partying. He'd been using drugs and drinking daily since high school, habits intensified by the art world. Philbrick had also been regularly snorting cocaine and taking MDMA and ketamine, all in relation to the job. That is, after all, how art deals are done, his attorneys would claim. I always drank too much, he concedes in one of our exchanges, but would always stagger away with a couple of deals done. I spent money on clothes, but there's no unshod art dealer, and private planes were a great setting for closing deals. Philbrick's ascent paralleled a historic moment that ArtNet writer Eileen Kinsella has called the financialization of the art market. Today, art is no longer merely displayed for admiration and pleasure, but often tucked away in storage facilities from New York to Hong Kong. Enterprising dealers sell shares to individuals and corporate entities, many of them offshore, only to flip them again when the prices rise. There is no authority overseeing which collector owns which works, nor any real way to know how much a middleman, such as Philbrick, has paid for a work he then divides into tranches. The New York Times labeled this new collecting class speculectors. Where I'm the rogue, I have no problem with wearing the scarlet letter, Philbrick wrote in his first email to me in April 2023. It is an admission of guilt, but also, like much of what follows, a promise that there is more to his story, a tale made possible by its setting, the global art market. With sales of $67.8 billion in 2022 alone, Philbrick became a wizard of its especially opaque secondary market, where pre-owned works are sold and resold, and dealers take a commission of between 5% and 20% on each flip. Work there rises and falls according to an artist's heat, which Philbrick was proficient at stoking, bidding up pieces at auction, courting prestige-conferring museums, and, of course, talking up potential buyers and sellers. He specialized in selling Yayoi Kusama pumpkins, Christopher Wool canvases, Wade Guyton abstracts, and most infamously a photorealist mashup untitled Picasso 2012 by Rudolf Stengel, the Italian artist whose fortunes Philbrick so excelled in predicting that he called himself Stingledamus after Nostradamus, the artist Kenny Schachter once wrote. Along the way, he became an art market avatar, personifying its wealth-generating potential and its unchecked excesses. As long as an artist's prices kept rising, Philbrick and his clients prospered. He was very well-versed. You trusted him, says one, who may have been among the first to invest in percentage shares of paintings with Philbrick. I think he saw how easy it was to get people to trust him enough to go into partnership and buy a portion of a work. Maybe that was the early stages leading into the fraud. Philbrick maintains that he was a novice in financial maneuvers, which he left to a young consultant he met at White Cube, who would become something of a protege. I would never have had an offshore company, nor an art-backed loan had I not met Robert Newland, Philbrick says. Total nonsense, Newland's attorney Roger Burlingame says of this claim. The only other person charged in connection with Philbrick's case, Newland was sentenced to 20 months in prison in September 2023 after pleading guilty to one count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud. A Wales-born London School of Economics graduate and young father of two, Newland worked at McKinsey and Christie's before becoming commercial director of White Cube in 2012. There, his attorney would later write in a sentencing memo, he discovered that the gallery world exists seemingly untouched by even the most basic principles Rob had learned in business school. Reviewing the books, Newland saw that a young art trader named Inigo Philbrick had been generating 10 times the profits of the entire 150-person operation. To keep the star from bolting, a proposal was made to place him in golden handcuffs. He was granted 50-50 ownership of a company called Philbrick Limited. According to the memo written by Newland's attorney, the lion's share of the financing for the new company was provided by a third party. The name of the third party was redacted from Newland's filing. Philbrick says he was in a partnership with Jay Jopling. Jopling declined to comment for this story. Philbrick would do the trading, and the profits would be split, according to the memo. But both sides seemed to chafe at the arrangement. Soon, Philbrick started looking for financing elsewhere, with Newland's help. The pair could dominate the art world, Newland thought, if he could just bring Philbrick's blazing talent under appropriate management. Under Philbrick's tutelage, Newland was transformed, educated on dress codes and watches, wines and menus. I was desperate to impress him, Newland wrote in his own letter to the court. The business consultant was also participating in some of Philbrick's trades. Investing his life savings of $100,000 on one sale and quickly doubling his money. After 4 years of dreaming of world domination, Newland left White Cube to join Philbrick's operation. He soon realized that the finances were in chaos. And so Newland became, in his attorney's words, the day-to-day back office for Philbrick's fraud, counseling on how to keep it all from collapsing. Episode 3, The Love Story. In August 2016, Philbrick was on a yacht chartered by the London-based investor Alexander Sasha Pesco. Both a client and a friend, Pesco invited Philbrick and his live-in girlfriend, the Argentinian artist and designer Francisca Mancini, to join a week-long Mediterranean cruise. Enter onto this sun-splashed yacht anchored just off Corsica, Victoria Baker Harbor, 28, a whirlwind with a supermodel's stature and a Regent's Business School education. 5 feet 8 inches tall, her ombre blonde hair billowing to her waist, Baker Harbor was best known as the quick-witted villain on the British reality TV series Made in Chelsea. In 2013, with the cast gathered around the holiday dinner table, she responded to an insult with an instantly memed rejoinder. Don't effing open your effing fat effing mouth, you effing fat turkey. On aboard the yacht, champagne flute in hand, Baker Harbor took one glance at the skinny Philbrick and thought, this is going to be an effing boring trip. He wasn't my type, she tells me, over lunch at a fashionable London restaurant. Philbrick had never watched Made in Chelsea, and although he was traveling with his girlfriend, he was nonetheless thunderstruck. She staggered me. Vivacious. Exciting, he says. Baker Harbor tells me that in the months after they met on the yacht, she deliberately steered clear of Philbrick. He was living with Mancini, and they would soon have a daughter together. Forbidden fruit, she called him, ignoring his incessant text, until one night, while having dinner at the London restaurant China Tang, and convinced that Feel Brick was unencumbered, she relented. "Feel free to stop by," she responded. "I'll be there in 5 minutes," Philbrick replied. At the time, Philbrick's businesses were hauling in revenues of approximately $100 million annually. Later that night, showing her his gallery, he leaned over and kissed her. Baker Harbor was entranced. He could hold an entire room in awe just by discussing the context of an artist's work or what it represented, she says. From that point forward, we were together nonstop. Fast forward to May 2019. They'd been a couple for nearly 2 years with no talk of permanence. Philbrick had never told her about his business problems, which were multiplying, and while she never understood the intricacies of art world finance, she says, I merely saw buying and selling and flipping as something tantamount to commodity or stock trading. On a walk through Hyde Park, he gave her a glimpse behind the curtain. I laid out my relationship with Jay Jopling and his financing of my business, as well as the fact that I may have done illegal things in trying to resolve my untenable situation with jointly owned artworks between multiple parties. She probably didn't believe me. The whole world knew me as this Wunderkind art dealer. How could it be otherwise? Of course, at this point, Philbrick believed that he could salvage his sinking business, a faith he clings to even writing from prison years later. If prices had risen, he says, everyone would have been paid. It had worked before. The aim was always to pay everyone out, and with a profit, something I managed many times, despite the over 100% percentages sold, he says. By no means am I blameless, but the people I was partnered with were all seeking an edge, he says. Until the very last moment, I'd been squaring off debts, paying out profits, and closing accounts, Philbrick says. I wanted to believe him. From prison, thousands of miles away, he had done to me what he had done to his investors, seduced me, sold me, convinced me of his at least partial innocence. Then I spoke with the FBI. Episode 4, The Law. The FBI art crime team are the high sheriffs of the art market. The Philbrick case, with at least 24 alleged victims across the world, was an insanely complicated puzzle that took months to understand. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.